I wish you would take up some more of my time. This is the first time I've been to this conference, and you know, conferences all differ in one way or another, and CB invited me down here, and I certainly appreciated that, and we got here yesterday morning, and he took me to my room and opened the door and walked in, and there was a woman in the bed. And and I backed out in the hall and I said, CB, I appreciate it, but I told you, I told you that my wife was coming with me. Well, I found out this morning when they were giving out corsages and I wanted one, it was either or. Yeah. When I turned her down, I lost a corsage too. My name is Jerry Eller, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Hi, everyone, and I am more grateful than I can say to be here this morning and be sober. I believe that this is a miraculous program. I believe that we're all miracles. My entire life revolves around miracles. I believe that it was a miracle that I lived to get here. I believe that my entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous was done in a miraculous way. And the miracles have not ceased to come in the last 21 years since I've met you people. I was born back in Western Carolina, Caldwell County, back towards Boone. I packed up my family and moved up to Virginia when I was a year old, and that was the first mistake I made. My father was a barber, and things were pretty hard back there in the mountains, and he knew some people up in Roanoke, went up there, and he opened up a barber shop. That's a little important later on to me. I think it had some effect on my life. I from the very earliest days that I can remember, I felt different than other people. I felt different from the kids that I played with. I felt that I was older than they were. On the one hand, I enjoyed their company. On the other hand, I didn't think I was like them. I wanted to be alone. It was sort of a mixed up thing. I did spend a lot of time alone. When I was very, very young, I would run away from home. I would just simply get out on the highway and start hitchhiking. I really didn't care where I was going, and I had no reason to. I came from a very good home. My mother and father were very loving people. I had a brother and a sister that I got along well with. This was back during the Depression, and things were tough, but I didn't really know that. It was tough for everyone. I didn't feel deprived at all, but I had this itch to be somewhere else. I think that was part of the isms. I think that I always felt that I would be a better person, I would be happier, I would be somehow a different person if I were somewhere else. And it didn't really matter where, I didn't know where. And I would get out and I would hitchhike, drove my parents crazy. They would get postcards from me from New Orleans, New York, and I was just a kid. When I was 12 years old, I think my dad sensed that I probably wouldn't stay in school, and he took me into the barber shop and taught me how to barber, and he gave me a chair down there. He had a six-chair barber shop downtown in Roanoke, and I could go down there on Friday afternoon and Saturdays, and I could make more money on Friday afternoon and Saturdays than most of the kids my age were getting in an allowance in a year's time. And in my condition and the way I thought and the way I did things, that probably wasn't very good for me. I started going to school when I wanted to go. I was 12 years old. We had truant officers back then. I would just quit going to school. Then they would call me in and they would expel me. And then the truant officer would come and say I had to go back to school. But before I could go back to school, I had to ask them if I could come back to school. You know, I didn't want to go in the first place. They threw me out. Then I had to ask them if I could come back, but they were going to make me come back. I remember one time I was going to one school, and I said I would go back to school if they'd let me go across town. They had districts, and they didn't want you to cross those lines. And I read the note that one principal sent to the other, said Jackson Junior High School doesn't want Lee Junior High School problems, and they had heard of me, I guess. But they did let me go over there, and I'd been over there a week, and we got a hold of, I don't know where they came from, but we got hold of some stink bombs, and I put them in the heating system over there, and they expelled me again. And all the time I was working down there at the barbershop, and I had money, a lot more money than any of the kids that I knew. When I was 13 years old, I looked older than I. I know this sounds juvenile, what I was just saying, but I looked older and could act older than I was. And when I was 13, I got a driver's license and I bought an automobile. I bought a 1936 Packard that was as long as this podium up here. From an old lady. I'd love to have that car, and that was a beautiful car. It was a town car. It was longer than a normal Packard sedan. I could get 12 people in it, and that's usually what I had in it because I had money. They had drive-in restaurants in Virginia then. You could buy beer on the curb, and if you had wheels and money, you could buy the beer. And I usually had that car packed full of people, and I furnished the money, and I bought the beer. And I had the automobile, and I thought everybody liked me. and it was great. I was doing everything that I wanted to do. But then I started getting in trouble with it. I started getting mean when I would drink, and I started getting in fights. And I knew I wasn't drinking like the other kids. They would, if it was there, they would drink some. If it wasn't there, it didn't matter. If it wasn't there, I wasn't going to be there. I knew that my feelings toward alcohol was different from other folks. When I was about 14 years old, I bought a truck. I had an uncle lived up here at Statesville, and he was in the produce business. He and his sons were in the produce business, and I used to go down there and drive with them down to Columbia at the farmer's market, and I thought that was the greatest thing in the world, get out on the highway and drive that old truck of his, that's what I wanted to do. So about the time World War I was closing and trucks were very scarce, I lucked across a ton-and-a-half Chevrolet truck, and I got it, and I went into the produce business. And my knowledge of the produce business was riding up down the road a couple times with my uncle, and I didn't know anything about it, but I loved driving that truck. And I did what I had seen him do, and it worked out fine. I would come down here and buy a load of peaches and go up here in some big cotton mill town and sell them off the back of the truck, and I was doing good. But I went up North Wilkesboro one time and bought a load of loose apples, a ton and a half steak bed bodied truck load of loose apples. And I took them to Winchester, Virginia. And I don't know whether y'all know about Winchester, Virginia. That's the apple country of the East Coast. And tried to sell those apples. And people would look at me and say, "Boy, where are you from? Where'd you get these apples?" And of course, I couldn't sell them. And I took them back to Roanoke and I didn't even know it myself, but they had froze. And I asked a lady I knew if I could put them in her garage and store them till I could sell them, and she said, yeah, and I put them all in her garage. Remember, these are loose. They're not in baskets or anything. And we had a warm snap, and they all thawed. And she had every fly and bee in Roanoke County in her garage. Had to shovel them things out. I had a lot of fun with that truck. I couldn't make any money with it. Kept it for a couple of years, in fact. I'd bought a barbershop. My dad, he didn't know what to do with me. I wouldn't go to school. Wouldn't do anything that anybody suggested that I do, really. They had padlocked the barbershop there for gambling, and they just practically had to give it away. And I had saved some money. My dad had taken it away from me and put it in the bank. He insisted that I buy this barbershop, that if I wasn't going to school and I was going to play around with that old truck and lose money, that I ought to have some, I had a trade, I'd learned to barber, and that I should have some way to you know, something to do. And I did. I bought that barbershop. Hated barber. Never did want to be a barber. But I had some good people there working for me, and it worked out fine. And I decided the reason I wasn't making any money with that truck, it wasn't big enough. And so I heard about this garage up in Northwest Roanoke who could extend the wheelbase on it. So I went up there, and they said yes, they could do it. So I left it there. It was a short wheelbase truck, and they were going to make a long wheelbase truck out of it so I could haul more apples up to Winchester, I guess. I don't know what. And I was coming back downtown. I was walking. I suppose I was walking back down to the barbershop. I used that for a home a lot. I had a back room in there, and I had a bed. We had shower baths in the place, and I lived there most of the time in the barbershop. My mother died when I was very young. And I lived there most of the time. And I know probably that's where I was heading for that day, but I passed by a recruiting office, and they had that big picture, and I know those of you who are old enough have seen it. There was a picture of a pilot out there with goggles on and a leather helmet and a big white scarf blowing out behind him. And I decided that's what I wanted to be. He looked great, and I went in, and it was Army Air Force then. It was before they split off from the Army. And the man told me that everyone, I wanted to go in the Air Force, but he said everyone had to go in the infantry first. And then when I came out of basic training, I was to tell them that I was in the Air Force. So I joined up and left town that night on the train, went to the West Coast, and I've not seen that truck till this day. I have no idea what they did with the truck. But I got through basic, and I went to the orderly room, and I told the first sergeant, "Where do I go? I'm in the Air Force." And when he got through wiping his eyes, and he called some of the company officers out, and they went and got the company commander and went through the whole thing again, and they were sitting in the floor laughing. Well, I didn't go in the Air Force. I spent an enlistment in the infantry, and believe it or not, I liked it. It was unbelievable, or maybe it wasn't, I don't know, but having come up being so disorganized and there was just something about the Army I liked, that there was a time for everything, a place for everything, and everything had to be in its place. I wore the uniform well. I had all my uniforms tailored. I really liked the Army. I was just a kid enough. I was in infantry, went through basic, went through infantry, advanced infantry training, and I'd go down to coming out of basic training, they made me a corporal. Now, this was not long after World War II, and they were downgrading people. I had gotten acquainted with some of the older sergeants in the outfit while I was going through basic. And they had seen something in me that I was yet to find out. They knew that I drank the way they drank. So when I came out of basic, they just made me a corporal so I could go to the NCO club with them. That's the only qualifications I had. And so I did, and I would go to the NCO club every night and get drunk and go out there and play soldier all day, run them down hills and fire off blanks and, you know, like a kid playing cops and robbers. And I loved it, every minute of it. And were so enthusiastic about it that they liked me, you know. They thought I was a good soldier. I was too far away to come home because I never could save any money to come home. So when I was discharged, I came home. I had 90 days to re-up, and I'd made buck sergeant by then. And within 90 days I could reenlist and keep the buck, and I came home and I drank. And in 90 days got away from me, and I couldn't get back in, and my ego wouldn't let me go back as a private, so I didn't go back in, and there I was with that old barber shop that I didn't care about. I had found out something about the barber shop that I didn't find necessary at first. Later on, it was that if you woke up in a barber shop, and if you were broke, and if you were hungover, that there was some stuff there that would get you down to the store, you know, which helped a lot. You know, it took a little work. It's hard to shake out enough in your hand to lap it up like a dog, but and it'll make you smell good. Oh, you smell wonderful, but you can tell it, and it'll work. We had some stuff. We had stuff there at 75 proof, and a lot of people wasted it putting it on their head. We had some stuff there they called Osage Rub, and it was 90 proof. And they used it for hair tonic and shaving lotion, and the barbers down there, and this was a pretty rough bunch down there, they swore that it would kill crab lice. So, and they ought to know. But you could drink it. The army thing didn't really matter too much, because a year later the Korean War started and I was immediately called in. And the reason I was immediately called in was because I had become an instructor the first time on recoilless rifles. And that was a strange new weapon that they came in right at the end of World War II, and they experimented with them between then and 1950 in the Korean War. And I was an expert on recoilless rifles, so they knew they were going to need people like me, and I was immediately recalled. One of the first people in Roanoke went back in the Korean War. Somehow they forgot that. I never gave a class, never saw a recoilless rifle the entire time I was in. I ended up being a train commander, hauling troops all over the country. And I stayed drunk most of the time. I'd still be in the Army if I could have kept that job on a regular basis. I would get orders to escort so many troops from this post to that post and be back on or about. Now that I like that, on or about, you know. And I always come back about. And I was on per diem, and I was making good money, and I never ever met a dining car steward that didn't have a fifth in his bag. So I loved that job. I came home and was going overseas. Came home and a young lady that I had dated, we decided to get married. I would have to say she lived a very sheltered life. Her mother and father were extremely good people. And I mean that in the very best sense of the word. They were religious people. They were good people. They were kind, decent people. And they certainly didn't understand me. I didn't understand them either, but we got married, and they put me down here at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and it was a madhouse down there. They had two divisions down there, and there were people living in trucks and garages and basements. And I finally found an apartment down there. It was next door to the State Insane Asylum in Columbia, and it was one room in the back of an old house. And the kitchen was in a pantry, and you had to wash the dishes and everything in the bathroom. And it had one old brass bed in there, and a refrigerator was in the bedroom, and it was one of those old ones with that big round thing up on top, and it would crank up and shake the whole house. And two old wooden lawn chairs in there. And this old woman, she must have been 95, maybe 100, she wore these long, filmy-looking nightgowns or dresses or whatever they were, and she sort of floated, you know. She did. And it was her house, and you could wake up 3 o'clock in the morning, she'd be going through the bedroom, you know. Just, And you wake up and that refrigerator done went off and the door flew open, the light come on, and there she goes by, you know. And hell, I'd have to get up and take a drink. And they were working us to death out there anyway. I was getting home at midnight, and the Jeep would be there to get me. I'd leave her at 4 o'clock in the morning. And my wife, just a kid, and she's down there in this place, living next door to the insane asylum, with an old woman who ought to have been over next door. And she finally decided she ought to go home. And I thought that, well, every time we did get a night off and go out, in South Carolina, you can only drink where they got birds and beasts and things. You know, the Lions Club or the Eagles or the Snakes or something. That's the only place you can get a drink of liquor, except in a bootlegging joint, was you got to be an animal of some kind and join, you know. All of our first dinnerware and stuff had eagles and lions. I stole it all, you know. And every time we would go out, the way we'd get home, it'd be four or five of my buddies carrying me and her walking along behind carrying my cap. And they'd, you know, and so anyway, she went home, gave me a warrant, and asked me to stay in, and I was going to Germany. And I said, honey, this is a great deal. And boy, she didn't want anything more to do with the Army. She said, no, first time you get a chance to get out, you get out. So they did let me out. They had made too many warrants. They didn't want us. So they did let me take a discharge. And I came home, had the barbershop, didn't want to work there, tried a lot of things. And I could talk myself into things. Really, I had some good jobs. I worked with Firestone Rubber Company. I worked for American Viscose Corporation. Worked for the Norfolk Southern Railroad at one time in Norfolk, and I liked the railroad. I just didn't, at that time, I was single. I was down there by myself, and I didn't like Norfolk. So I came on back home. For about 5 years, I did a lot of things, and I made good money, and we had drove nice cars, and we didn't have any children for 5 years, and we went to a lot of parties, a lot of good times. And I drank a lot. And it's apparent now, looking back, and had been for a long time, that the drinking was progressing. And we've been married 5 years, and our first child was born, a little girl. And as I did everything that I ever intended to do right, as an adult anyway, they sent me to the store to get something. They were getting ready to take Sally to the hospital. And of course I went to the wrong store, and I didn't get to the hospital for about 3 days to find out I had a little girl. But I never was any place that I was supposed to be sober when anything important happened. That was a big year for me because my daughter was born and I went to work on the railroad in Roanoke. I went to work as a brakeman and I loved it. I found people there who drank the way I did. It was sort of like the Army all over again. I really enjoyed the railroad. Next June, I'll have 40 years in on this railroad, and I've never looked for another job. Well, that's not true. They fired me one time, and I looked for another job, but by then, it wasn't anybody to hire me. So, but the drinking progressively worsened. 8 years later, the children were 8 years apart. That might tell you how much I was drinking during that time. But by the time the little boy came along, things had gotten pretty bad. My health had gotten bad. I had bleeding ulcers. I had all the things that come with alcoholism. I had DUIs. I didn't have a driver's license, a bill collector's. But I didn't work regularly. And at that time on the railroad, you could get away with it. Had a huge extra list, what we call the extra board. If I wanted off, all I had to do was pick up the telephone, say, Mark Brakeman L or Conductor L are off, and I could stay off as long as I wanted to. They didn't pay you, but they didn't say anything about you being off. It made it too easy for people like me to get off, and I did stay off a lot. I took a job one time. I was supposed to have been working a five-day week as a yard conductor, and I took a job. I was going to open up a man's filling station for him each morning for $4 each morning. And Sally said, "Why in hell are you doing this?" And I said, you certainly ought to know better than anybody. We need the money. She said, "Well, you're only working 3 days a week on a five-day job that pays you $100 a day, and you're going to go down there and open up a filling station for $4. I said, "That's right. I have to work two jobs to support us." You know? Now, that made sense to me. I took bankruptcy, and I would steal, I would lie, I would do anything, but somehow I honestly believed that I was an honest person. So I took that type of bankruptcy where they take money out of your pay and they pay you creditors. They call it different places in different places. That's what I did. But I found out that they gave this money to a lawyer who took care of it for you, and if you had an emergency, you could get some of it back. And I've got all the records. I've kept them. I've got them at home right now. That the house we bought an old house, a big old 8-room frame house. And I put 6 roofs on that house and 3 furnaces. I put 5 transmissions in 1 old car. And all I was doing was just going down there and coming up with an emergency to get enough money to drink on, and that put the end of the creditors weren't getting paid, and that put it off and off and off and off. Finally got that thing paid off. And I said, "Man, I'll never go through this as long as I live." And I found out when I got it paid off, my credit was good. I could go anywhere, get anything, and in 6 months I was under the damn wage earners plan again. So It was miserable. It was miserable for my family. The money part sticks in my mind a lot because somehow that seemed to bother me at that time worse than anything. I didn't think I was drinking too much. I didn't blame anything on my drinking. I blamed it on Sally on the job, but mostly on bill collectors. And they would come and turn the water off. I had a wrench made just to turn it back on. I'd have it back on before they got out of sight. I piped around the gas meter. You know, that way I didn't have to pay anything, and I got all the gas I wanted. I was afraid to do it. You could do it with an electric meter, but I was scared of electricity, and I didn't. So what I did do, I ran a line over in my neighbor's basement, and he didn't know about it. And he was a drinking buddy, but he didn't know about the line I'd run in his basement in through the window. And we'd sit out in the backyard and drink, and he said, "Is your light bill going up?" And I said, "No." Oh. But it was terrible. It was. And I hated bill collectors. I had a little young bill collector came to the door one time, and I was drunk. Boy, he just gave me a hard time. And I got him in and got him drunk and got him to call his boss and cuss him out. And they fired him right there. That thing just tickled me to death. Got that boy fired. They'd come take the tags off my car. Because I hadn't, you know, I had 2 or 3 DUIs. And they finally, they wouldn't let Sally have a license unless she had special insurance, simply because I lived in the house. And if I did take the car and get caught, which happened quite a bit, she had to swear that I stole her car or they would confiscate. It went on like that 17 years, and it got worse and worse and worse. I went to work one night. As usual, I was drinking. I never let work interfere with that. I went to work. I was drinking. Something happened that night they couldn't overlook it anymore, and they took me out of service, and I knew what that meant. They were going to hold a formal investigation and fire me. And that's exactly what happened. That went on for a long time. I didn't want to go down there drunk, and I couldn't get sober to go down there, so we kept postponing the investigation. They took me out of service in April of 1972, and they didn't get me down there to fire me until up in June 1972. But they did fire me for Rule G. The man who was the investigating officer called me off by myself, and he said, "Jerry, in a lot of respects, you've been a good brakeman and a good conductor, and we hate to lose you. And if you could find a way not to drink, we'd like to have you back. And if you ever do that, I'll try to get your job back for you." And my first thought was, that is a piece of cake. I never, ever tried to quit drinking. And I thought, all I've got to do is quit drinking, and I'm going to get my job back. And I wanted that job back. 17 years, and I liked the railroad. And you know, I made it a week, and I walked in a restaurant one day, was a delicatessen, and I was, I went to the hospital to get dried out so I could go to the investigation. So I hadn't had a drink for a week, and I was feeling good. It was in the summertime, and I walked into a restaurant, and I ran into a fellow who didn't know about my problems. He ordered us a beer, and I simply sat down and drank a beer. The book tells us that we have no mental defense against alcohol, and I knew that before I came to AA. I sat down and drank a beer. He left and went on back to work. I drank several more and went to the whiskey store. And I didn't draw another sober breath for another 18 months. I was caught twice more during that period of time for DUIs. I was in and out of jail for simply being drunk on the street. Finally woke up in jail one day, and I'd been there a week, and I didn't remember most of it. And had been in DTs for the first time in my life. And I'd had another wreck. No driver's license, 7 charges. And they took me before a judge for a preliminary hearing. He almost had to carry me down there. And he told me that he was going to give me a year in jail when the trial come up, but he was tired of seeing me there. Put me back in jail, and my daughter, I couldn't get anyone to get me out this time. I had a bonds lady who I'd put all her kids through college, and she wouldn't come down and get me out. My wife wouldn't come and get me out. My daughter finally prevailed on one of my brother-in-laws to come and get me out. And we no longer got in. Quick as we got in his car, I asked him if he had $5. And he gave it to me, and I asked him to stop at the whiskey store. And I bought a fifth of the cheapest whiskey I could buy. And I couldn't even get back to the car. I started drinking it right there in front of the liquor store. I got home, and I had word that I couldn't stay there any longer. I had to get my stuff and get out. It was time to go, and I knew this had to be. But I drank myself unconscious, and it didn't take a lot at that time. I woke up the next morning on the floor, and that's the first time that I ever had a truly conscious, overwhelming desire not to drink anymore. And I thought, God, if there's a way to stay sober, I've got to find it. I was in terrible health. I had bleeding ulcers. I was about 35 pounds underweight. I looked like a skeleton. I had cirrhosis of the liver. I had pancreatitis. I was in terrible shape. And I knew I was dying. And I knew I'd lost everything that meant anything to me. But I didn't know how. I had quit one time, and I didn't make it a week. And I didn't know any other way. I got a six-pack that day, and until this day, that's the last thing I drank. But I still didn't know what to do. I simply didn't drink. I sat in an old chair there and sweated it out for a week. My wife didn't force me to leave because I was too sick to get out the door. And I think she saw that I did want to do something. She saw something she'd never seen before. And so she didn't push the issue, although we both knew the marriage was over. I didn't drink for 3 months. I didn't do anything. I simply hurt. I cursed. I sweated. And I wanted a drink. 24 hours a day, every day, I wanted a drink. I did very little sleeping. It was the worst 3 months I've ever been to in my life. In January, the company that I'd been fired from was still sending me their company magazine. which was a monthly publication, and there was a little article in it that said that they had started something. I worked, as I said, for a railroad. They had started something that they had chosen to call the Alcoholic Rehabilitation Service. And there was a little article in there about it, and it said that they would be under the auspices of the company medical director. Well, I lived in the headquarters town in Roanoke, and I wrote a letter to the company medical director, and I addressed it, and I put a stamp on it, and like any good drunk, I went down and handed it to him. And he read it, and he patted me on the back, and he said, "You're the first one, and I got a man I want you to talk to." He was so new that this man that they had chosen for a counselor, he didn't have an office yet, and they had told me to go to his home. And I went to his home, beautiful home, nice section of town, and he had such a common name. His name was Jimmy Carter, and that was Jimmy Carter was running for president. It was such a common name that it didn't ring a bell until he opened the door. And what I saw, if I was the biggest drunk on one division in that railroad, I was looking at the biggest drunk on another division. That's what I knew him as. And I thought, this is the sickest damn joke that anybody could ever play on somebody, you know. But he invited me in, and we spent 4 or 5 hours together that afternoon in his living room, and we drank coffee and we talked. And I told him all the things you tell people in a situation like that, that I would never take another drink, that if my memory didn't fail me and I could remember all the things that had happened to me, that I would never, ever take another drink. Jimmy was the first man that I had ever talked to who was a recovering alcoholic. That, I think, is one of the miracles. I live in a town that the VA hospital has got a huge alcohol treatment thing up there. I must have drank with 10,000 people who had been to AA, and no one had ever mentioned AA to me. Jimmy is the first man that I felt ever understood me. He said, "I know you're not lying to me, because I've made those same promises, but I know you can't keep them without help." And he asked me if I would try AA, and that is all I knew of AA, just the word. I had no idea. I'm a prolific reader. I'll read anything. I read cornflake boxes. I read everything. But whether it's a psychological thing, I don't know. But I would never read anything about alcoholism. I would never go see Days of Wine and Roses or Lost Weekend. I didn't plan it that way. I just didn't do it. I would read an entire Reader's Digest, but if there was an article in there about alcoholism, I didn't read it. So I was totally ignorant. I went to my first AA meeting that night. He called a couple. They're both dead now. He was to be my sponsor for the next 15 years. A couple named Bill and Gladys Hollingsworth. I know there are people here who knew Bill. They took me to my first meeting that night, and they said the things that I used to hear the old-timers say. It's one of the biggest heartbreaks of being 21 years in AA. That used to, I think, if you got 20 years in AA, you're an old-timer and you're going to say some of them smart things. I got 21 years, I ain't said one yet. You know, they're making old-timers different than they used to. They didn't have to talk a whole lot to say anything. Gladys stopped me before we went into that church that night. She just took hold of my arm. And she said, "Jerry, when we go in here, you'll never have to take another drink or be alone again." I can't think of anything that woman could have said that would have made a greater impact on me. We were sitting in his house one day. When I was a kid, back during the Depression, a very little kid, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, used to be a lot of these tent preachers come around, you know, in the sawdust trail, and they'd always putting up tents, and mama's dragging papas down to there and getting them saved. And whether y'all knew it or not, they would pay kids a quarter to get baptized. Well, I came from a good family. They didn't know I was doing this. I've been baptized at least 12 times. I've been sprinkled, dipped, you name it. But I got a bad impression of preachers and organized religion. And so when I first came into AA, I had the same problem that I've heard over and over again from a lot of you folks. I had the God problem. You know, I loved you people. That first night, I fell in love with you people. I know I've heard a million people talk about their entrance into AA, and they hated the people, or they liked them, or they didn't give a damn one way or the other. I loved you people. That first night, I thought, these people have got something that I want. But then somebody would say something about God, and I'd think, well, except for him, you know. I didn't want to buy that. I thought of those kind of people as being crooks and rogues. I didn't trust them. It's over at Bill's house one night, and Bill and I were talking about something. And Gladys was sitting there knitting or doing something. Didn't even know she was listening to us. And I told Bill, I just can't handle this God thing. And Gladys turned around and she said, Jerry, right now, at this stage of your development, there's two things you need to know about God. There is one, and you ain't it. And there again, that made a hell of an impact on me. I've never forgotten those words. They always said things like that. We were at a meeting one night. We had started a meeting. It's after I'd been in AA for a while, and we were meeting in Fellowship Hall in the church, and the church had a clock. So somebody in one of us brought another clock, and we had a clock at each end of the room. And some guy, this young guy, was always sharpshooting Bill, and he liked AA, but he didn't want to get sober. He didn't want to do what he was supposed to do. And he never missed a chance of sharpshooting Bill Hollingsworth. And one night he noticed something, and he grabbed Bill, and he said, look at there. I said, that damn clock back there says 9 o'clock, and this one says 8 o'clock. I said, now, what do you think about that? Bill didn't miss a beat. He said, son, if we were both going to say the same thing, we wouldn't need but one clock. That old boy walked away shaking his head. But they could do that. They made sense out of everything he said. I listened to everything those people told me. I truly did. I didn't argue with you. I didn't argue with the book. And the miracles started happening. They truly started happening. I bought the big book in the 12 and 12, the first meeting I went to. Bought it on credit. I didn't have it a dime. Bought it on credit. Went home and read both of them that night. I said I was a prolific reader, and I did. I set up and read the 12 and 12 in the big book that night. But I started with the 12 and 12, and about the second paragraph I read in the foreword. And I've heard many times since then people say, I don't know how it works, but it works. I was told that first night how it worked. If you haven't read it in a long time, it's in the foreword, in the 12 and 12. About the second paragraph, it says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. That says it all. That's it. And I knew right then that I'd found a home. I got my job back. I got my wife back. I got my health back. I even got a driver's license back. I got my credit back. I can't tell you all the things. Well, everything that I'd lost, I got back. And I had lost everything. I was so damn proud of that driver's license. I went 21 years without one. And everybody wanted to see it. Until I got it. I was driving up Salem, a little town right out of Roanoke. I was driving up Salem one night, and they had a roadblock set up coming the other way, and I made a U-turn and got in line. Swear, so I could show them my driver's license. Got within about 5 cars of the cop, and they closed up shop and went home. And I'm standing there with my driver's license. Miracles, I believe in miracles. They simply happen. I'd been sober, went back on my job, loved my job. I'd been sober for 7 years. The company came to me and said, would you take a job with our ARS, with the Alcoholic Rehabilitation Service, as one of our counselors? And I did. It's what I've been doing for the last 16 years. And I have loved every minute of it. That in itself is a miracle. We have a very simple program. We try to direct people towards AA. That's it. Nothing else. We try to direct people towards AA. People who don't know, just as I didn't know, we say, you know, if you've got this illness, we know where you should go. And I have enjoyed it every minute of it. And the miracles that I have watched there. Let me tell you about one. This is in a few years ago they forced the issue through the federal government until we became the Drug Alcoholic Rehabilitation Service because of federal testing. So we had to learn a lot to know where to direct other people to. But I had a fellow, young black man in Washington, D.C. Young, he was in his 40s. And he was having a terrible time with alcohol, and he got straight. He got NAA. Got him back to work. He was doing great. He had a slip, and he got on drugs. And he got away from the railroad. I lost him, and I thought a lot of this man. And I'd met his wife and his family and been to meetings with him, and I just thought a great deal of him. Let me back up just one little bit. I was right out of Atlanta taking some college courses down there one time, and this lady was taking the courses with me, and her daughter was a marketing person for a treatment facility, and she kept wanting to talk to me, and I didn't want to hear about treatment facilities. I was down there for something else, and I know I cut her kind of short, and one day I was sitting in my office, and I'd lost contact with this man I mentioned in D.C., and I was in Roanoke, and I kept getting telephone calls from him, and he'd leave me messages, but he kept missing me, and he didn't have a phone. He was at a pay phone, and so I couldn't call him back. But I was there in the office one day when he called, and he said, Jerry, I've got AIDS, and he said, I weigh 90 pounds, and I can't get off the coke. And he said, I can only stay in these missions up here one night at a time, and I've got everything I own in a shopping bag, and I'm standing on the street corner, and I don't know what to do. Well, it caught me till I didn't know what to do either, really, because he needed hospitalization, and I knew that. He'd been gone from the railroad so long that his insurance had played out. And I said, give me your number, and stay right there. For God's sakes, don't move. Just stand right there. And let me see what I can do. He gave me his number, and I was sitting there just racking my brain. Who can I call? How can I handle this thing? And this damned idiot girl that had been pestering me down there in Georgia called, hi, this is, you know. And I said, lady, I haven't got time to talk to you. I've got a problem I'm working on right now. And she said, maybe I can help you. And I said, no, I don't think so. She said, well, try me. And I told her. I told her exactly what was going on. She said, Jerry, I know you were busy down there in Georgia, and I know you didn't hear what I had to say, but I work for a treatment facility that specializes in drug-addicted people who have AIDS. And I'm about 60 miles out of Washington, and I don't give a damn if he has insurance or not. And I gave her the number. And an hour later, they said, we got him. The man's still alive. He's been in remission now, strangely. He's been in remission now for several years, actually. He works in a halfway house, and is doing great. You know, why did she call me that day? Why did he call me that day? Miracles just keep on happening. They've happened to me over and over and over again, and I've watched them happen to other people. I don't know of any other place this happened. All I know is that it's a miracle that I'm here this weekend with people that I dearly love who have given me everything, everything. Through this program, you have given me, through this miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the God that you gave me that I didn't know when I got here. Thank you.